Hello everyone, I'm super excited to have Craig Andrews, the founder and owner of Allies For Me. Craig is the principal ally and founder of marketing agency Allies For Me. Using a proven method that mimics the stages of courtship, Allies For Me helps companies find strangers and convert them into high-paying customers. Not only that, but he's got two new books coming, which we're going to touch on a little bit today. One is Hope That Won't Die, a survivor story, co-written with his wife. And you hear some interesting insights into where the title came from. And then secondly, the focus of our podcast, which is going to be Make Sales Magical, which is about closing more deals faster and higher prices. So Craig, super to have you on the podcast today. How are you doing?
Doing very well, Nicholas. It's a delight to be here. I've been looking forward to it.
Yeah. Now, let's just dive quickly into the topic of your first book, because this goes a little bit into your background, and it's called Hope That Won't Die, a Survivor Story. And I want you to see how that segues into the second book that you're writing as well. So over to you.
Yeah. So in August 10th of 2021, I walked into the hospital, barely able to breathe, and they took me back behind the curtain and put me on oxygen. And a few minutes later, I heard my wife on the other side of the curtain, you know, saying, "Where's my husband? I want to see my husband." They said, "Ma'am, you have to leave. You have to go out into the car in the parking lot." This, of course, is in Austin, Texas, in August, which the parking lot in Texas is not a welcome place, but she went back out there, and I didn't realize at the time, but it would be another 2 months before I'd see her. Now, she'd see me sooner, but 12 days later, they called her in the middle of the night and convinced her to put me on the ventilator and then told her I was going to die. And they continued to tell her that for about a month. And at one point, they pulled her into a room, put my chart up on the wall. It said, "Prognosis, multiple organ failure leading to death." And at that time, the chart was highly credible because I was actually in kidney failure at that time. 6 weeks in the coma, my body had completely atrophied, so I had to learn how to walk again. And I lost 40 pounds in the hospital. I don't know how many kilograms that is, probably...
So what did you say? 60 pounds, that's about 30 kilograms. That's a Backstreet Boy, basically. Do you remember anything of that time you were under?
So I actually remember quite a bit. And but it's through a little bit of a different lens. So if you think about when it was first lights out, think of it as a continuum. So we go from lights out to full consciousness. Shortly after they put me under, I started having dreams. And the dreams closer on that side of the continuum greatly divorced from reality. The dreams shortly before full consciousness tightly tied to reality. Everything in between was sort of a grade. So there were elements of reality, but usually interpreted through a weird lens. And I've actually quoted things back to my wife that she said to me when I was in my coma.
Wow. So I guess that's why it's important for people to speak to their loved ones when they're in comas.
Yes. Yes. And the, you know, and we have a website up for the book Hope That Won't Die. It's at hopethatwon'tdie.com. And there's the introduction to the book is actually there. And for anybody that's curious what it's like, what somebody's experiencing when they're in a coma, obviously I can't speak for all people that are in comas, but we actually have it up on the website. You don't even have to buy the book to read the introduction. That will give you an idea of what my world was like for 6 weeks. And it was really interesting. And there was a lot of struggles. There was a lot of struggling, but the consistent theme was I was stuck and I was trying to get unstuck. But some of the delightful moments from my coma were, you know, and my dreams were with my wife. because she was the one who was diligently speaking life and hope into me. She, the hospital originally told her that they weren't going to allow her to visit, and she threatened to get a lawyer, and they acquiesced and allowed her to 1 hour a day. And thank goodness, I think she played a major role in my survival.
But one of the things that folks who've gone through traumatic experiences like this have is you hear on, I think it's on movies and with other anecdotes, that once somebody's had a near-death experience, their whole worldview changes afterwards. I think most people come out and just say, thank God, and then go back to working and doing their regular things. How has that been different for you? And how has potentially your relationship with your wife changed since your time in a coma?
Yeah. I would say many decisions in life remain unchanged, which, I'm happy about. The, one of the things I discovered when I woke up from my coma is that my team ran the business without me. And they actually delivered their best. When they were being told Craig is going to die, he's not coming back to work, they delivered their best. And so from that part, that was kind of affirming of decisions I made before the coma. But where it did change a lot of things was in my relationship with my wife. Myself, like I believe many married couples, found it easy to, argue about little inconsequential things. They didn't seem inconsequential at the time, but in hindsight, putting them in perspective, they're a lot more consequential than, or they're a lot less consequential than I thought. And so it's really had an enormously positive impact on my marriage. And I've told my wife, if for no other reason, everything we went through was worth it just for that. One of the things I noticed when I woke up was I didn't trust the doctors at all. So after 6 weeks, I woke up and my trust in the doctors had plummeted. It dropped through the floor, while my trust in my wife had gone through the roof. And my brain was still kind of cloudy, and so a lot of my actions were instinctual, not thoughtful or logical. But the doctors would come by, and they would want to do various things, and I would just tell them no. I didn't trust them. And that was the instinctive part of my brain that was operating. So they would go to my wife, and they'd ask to do something, and she'd come to me and say, the doctors want to do this. And I'd ask her, I said, is it safe? And she'd say yes, and I'm like, okay. And, looking back at it in hindsight, some of the things they were asking were immensely reasonable, not risky. With a clear mind, I would have said yes in a second. But I was acting off instinct. And after I left the hospital, I was trying to figure out, why was this? And as I started putting pieces together, I realized that people had been speaking into me in my coma. My wife had been speaking words of hope and life. But the medical staff had been speaking much different words of despair. And it changed the way I felt about them. And because it changed the way I felt about them, all of my trust in them vanished. And it reminded me of a Maya Angelou quote, where she said, people will forget what you said, they will forget what you did, but they will never forget how you made them feel. And as I started thinking about it, I realized, we've been doing these things called first-time offers for a while, and there's a whole host of reasons why they work very, very well. But it hit me, we're changing the way people feel. When we deliver a first-time offer, we're actually going in and changing the way they feel about us, not in a manipulative way. It's a very genuine, service way. But it makes changes in them that changes their instincts. In the same way my instincts, when I couldn't think clearly, my instincts said, don't trust the doctors. You can't trust them. And I believe that's because of a lot of the messages they sent through to me when I was, when they presumed I couldn't hear them. Well, when we're selling, our body language is sending messages. And we can't, unless you're a bona fide sociopath, you can't control these messages. And when people realize that they're being sold, they raise their guard and they get scared. They're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I don't want to buy anything. You know, leave me alone. And so what we do, we've been doing this for a little over half a decade, is we build something called a first-time offer, and it's a mini project that leads to a high-ticket offer. And it has a few elements to it. It's a impulse purchase. That means the coins in the cushion in the couch, the money in the wallet, or the B2B equivalent of that. And just to wrap some numbers around that, for B2B, we're almost always doing below $500 US dollars. And the reason we picked that number is anybody with any decision-making authority in an organization can spend $500 without asking permission. They can spend $500 and nobody will ever hold them accountable for how that money is spent. And so we're de-risking it. The second element is it has to deliver a disproportionate value to price. And usually we aim for 10x. So if it's $500, we're trying to deliver $5,000 of value for that $500. And I'm not talking some bogus value stack that, you know, your mama said you're really smart and people should pay you for this. We're talking about legit street value. Somebody would pay $5,000 for that. And so what that does for another type of prospect, the business owner or the chief executive who, you know, probably doesn't need to ask permission, it's removing the need to do any type of mental calculation. You know, when you have a impulse purchase with an insane amount of value attached to it, they don't have to calculate if it's a good deal. It's immediately obvious that it's a good deal. One of the things it does is it solves a problem. And one of the things that we know about human behavior, and this is where it ties into the book, Make Sales Magical, this is some of the magic. When you come along shoulder to shoulder with somebody in their life and you help them solve a problem, it releases oxytocin in the body. That's the bonding hormone that bonds baby to mother. It's an incredibly powerful hormone. And when you solve a problem for somebody in their life, it bonds you together. Going back to my hospital experience, my wife was constantly solving problems for me. She was constantly advocating for me, and she'd probably be horrified if she knew I was saying this, but one of the problems we faced was before I got out of the hospital, I was quite amorous. I couldn't walk, but I was going to do whatever I could, just because she had, you know, her care for me had stimulated so much of that oxytocin, you know, that I just wanted to be close to her. And so that's the third thing. The first thing is it's a impulse purchase. Second is it's disproportionate value to price. Third is it solves a problem. But you don't want to solve the big problems because you want them to advance to your core offer. So it leaves problems unsolved and it naturally leads to the next step, which is the core offer. And so putting all this together, I realized, you know, yet another reason why this process works and it closes more deals faster and at higher prices is we're changing the way people feel about us when we go into their life and we solve a small problem. And it builds trust faster than any mechanism that I'm aware of.
So I completely subscribe to that principle, starting small and building from there. But that first touch, that first step is generally one of the most difficult. Getting somebody even to, you know, go on that first date, to take that $500 challenge, basically. Can you give me an example of a business that you've worked on? It can be, and whether it's software or whatever type of B2B business it is, where this worked out?
Yeah, so we have built these for people that do outsource software developments. And the first time offer of $500 was basically planning out an entire software development, you know, up to a certain level, but basically giving somebody enough that, you know, let's say management came down and said, we want this new functionality. You know, what's the schedule and what's the budget? And, you know, usually a lot of times in software development, they're like, oh, I don't know. And they just kind of pick numbers at random. and they're busy. They don't have time, you know, to kind of think through this. And so what our client did for them was gave them basically 80% understanding of the project for $500. Let's think through this in terms of difficulty of that first sell. Well, if you're talking to a technical leader that has, you know, has any type of budget whatsoever, well, $500, he's not going to have to think about. He's like, oh, wait a minute, I pay you $500 and you're going to lay all this out for me that I can then go take to management and give them a realistic schedule instead of the goofy made up schedules that we give them. And I can deliver hard evidence to management of this is why we need this much time and this much money. $500? Yes. We had someone else that his customer was, he did commercial developments, and his customers were investors, family office folks usually that were managing the investments for very wealthy families. Like we, you know, I've lived next to Michael Dell's ranch, the computer guy. And now he has so much money, he built his own family office. But, you know, basically there's this function where you have a management team that manages your finances. Well, one of the things they're looking for are new and exciting ways to invest money to get better returns for their clients. And the typical investment for one of my clients' projects was about $5 million. And so he was going up to a investor trying to persuade them to give $5 million, which is a pretty big ask, especially when it's $5 million of their client's money. If they lose that, you know, their client's not going to think very well of them. And so we helped them construct an offer. And they, and these offers all should have four or five deliverables. This one did. But the biggest deliverable was on a $40 million project, we had them slice off $500,000 of special shares. And those $500,000 were put in five buckets. And the offer included going up to an investor, say, hey, look, you haven't worked with us before. We haven't worked with you. We'd like to get to know you better. We'd like you to get to know us better. For our new investors, here's what we do. If you buy $50,000 of shares, we will immediately match that $50,000 with another $50,000 of shares. So you can go back and tell your client that you're testing something new, and the only thing you know is you immediately doubled their money. And the question he asked me was like, well, who's going to pay for that other $50,000? You have a marketing budget, right? It's like, yeah. And we sat down, we did the math, and this was like 0.6% of the project cost. It's like, that's just a marketing cost. We're just shuffling the deck chairs here. And but think about how attractive that is to a family, you know, family office manager. Hey, I'm not asking you for $5 million. I'm asking you for $50,000, and just to make sure you look like a genius, I'm going to immediately give you $50,000 more in shares, so you can go back and tell your client you're testing something new and you doubled their money immediately.
I suppose it means you've got to understand your customer lifetime value really well. So the you can't just come up with these offers just randomly. I think what you've shown there is, again, the $5 million is the end point. And that cost of acquiring the customer, that's, as you said, absolutely a marketing cost. So it might sound expensive to some folks, but if you look at it realistically in terms of that's peanuts, and it's going to generate multiples of that, have multiple return over the years you have that customer as a client.
No, and you're very shrewd to pick up that is what you have to understand. And you have to know your lifetime value. I would say you don't have to be precise. You have to be in the ballpark.
Yeah.
You know, and what I find is many people don't know their customer lifetime value, which is fine. We help them figure it out. We, you know, sit down and usually they throw out some numbers and we pick the lower side of the range, because even working from the lower side of the range, usually there's enough lifetime value in the account that we can build a really powerful offer and just pack some of that in. It makes the marketing shorter and easier. And, you know, think about in the case of this developer, it's like, okay, how many dinners are you taking this developer out to? How much of your time are you spending? you know, and when, or not developer, but investors. And when you're taking investors out to dinner, I'm presuming that you're not taking them to McDonald's. You're probably taking them to a very nice steakhouse. And it's expensive, you know, it adds up. It's like, just cut all that out. Make it easy for them to say yes. Make it, make them look stupid if they say no. Put an offer together that's so good they would look foolish to say no to it.
So Craig, you've given a fantastic example here, and it sort of clarified in my head how your first time offer methodology works. But obviously it goes, there's a bit more depth in that in the book. So obviously, again, to encourage folks to go and look at some other ways that this can be applied in different industries. So that's for trying to get $5 million out of somebody. What other examples are there? Airlines, software obviously must be one in finance. What interesting industries have you worked on with this principle of FTO?
Yeah, so for the outsourced software development, you know, typically they were looking at a $75,000 to $150,000 development. So doing $5,000 of estimating for $500, that's pulling that lifetime value out of that. So that's an example. If you have any type of consultants or agencies, it works wonderfully for that. That's why I developed it. I'm horrible at sales. I'm truly, truly horrible at sales. And because I couldn't sell, I had to create an environment where people wanted to buy. And so I developed this for my own purpose originally, and it started working so well, I just thought, oh, wow, other people need this. It was so transformative for me. So consultants, B2B service businesses, it could be B2C. So another place that I think it works wonderfully is financial advisory services. Higher ticket, very high trust. You know, very high trust to you know, pull in one of these. You know, you're asking people to hand over their life savings. And so that's a another place. This is kind of funny. This is an example of broken thinking. It's a perfect place where somebody could have used one of these, but broken thinking prevented them from using it. I have a friend that's an accountant and fractional CFO, and I think very highly of him. Wonderful, wonderful guy. And he told me about a new service he was launching that was going to be a monthly fee where $60, I think it was $360 a month. He would keep your taxes in order for the full year, and that would include the tax preparation. And so and he was telling me about this in February of this year of 2023. And in the U.S., business taxes have to be filed on March 15th. And so I asked him, I said, do you have enough capacity to take on 5 new clients with this? He said, oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. He said, I have excess capacity. I said, okay. I said, here's your offer. And this is still kind of simple. It doesn't meet the requirement in 4 or 5 deliverables. But I said, email your list, tell them anybody that hasn't filed their 2022 taxes, you will do their 2022 taxes for $360 as long as they enroll in this program. And their first month's fee is to cover last year's taxes. And he's like, oh no, I couldn't do that. I'm like, why not? Oh, I'm leaving money on the table. You know, I would normally charge over $1,000 to do their taxes. I'm not going to do their taxes for $360. I'm like, but you have 5 new clients immediately that are going to pay you thousands of dollars. You know, this is just an acquisition cost. And he's like, no, I'm not going to do it. Mm-hmm. 4 months later, he was celebrating signing up his first client. And I'm just sitting there thinking, how many thousands of dollars did you walk away from because you got all wrapped around the axle about losing $700 on customer acquisition?
It goes back to understanding the customer lifetime value, and it's that short-sighted thinking, as you've just highlighted here, that sets lots of people back. I'm leaving money on the table. I think lots of managerial books and lots of people have said, you know, try and squeeze every penny that you can out of folks. And we've got to realize that business is a long game. And all of these folks have been overnight successes, have been 5-10 years to become overnight successes because they're playing a slightly longer game. And I think the folks who understand that principle would have taken that idea of yours and gone, oh yes, that's a smart idea, let's go for it. And I'm sure that can be applicable to a whole bunch of different industries as well. So really, really nice insight there. I want to talk a little bit about your background now that we've spoken about quite a bit of what's happened currently. But you studied in Japan, you've been in the Marines, you've worked in semiconductor businesses or businesses in very sort of high tech spaces. How did you move from that into sales?
Well, so yeah, great question. So when I got out of the Marines, and my time in the Marines, I was basically a reformation project of myself. I was, you know, nobody ever accused me of being a model student in high school. And so I had to do something different. I went in the Marine Corps for 6 years. It was an amazing time. And I was in the Marines, I was working on electronic warfare systems. We would jam radars. Not very sexy. When we flew over, nothing happened. And that was the definition of success. You know, we'd blank out people's radars, or we'd put false targets on their radars and different things like that. But I thought, you know, I like being creative, and engineers create things, so I'll become an engineer. And I got a bachelor's and a master's degree in electrical engineering. And my first job out of university was working for Ericsson. That's what took me to Sweden, to Lund. And I discovered engineering is not a very creative place. They do not reward creativity there. and it's very constrained. So I was like, well, what can I do? And I'm not really a sales guy. I'm a marketing guy. But marketing only makes sense when the cash register rings. And so I thought, well, let me try marketing semiconductors. And so I marketed semiconductors for mobile phones for about a decade. Drove about $500 million in revenue through that. And, you know, in that, I, you know, went to some of the world's largest mobile phone makers, you know, Motorola back when they were still a player, Nokia when they were still a player, Ericsson back when they still made phones. And they could never figure the customer out. They could never figure out the consumer. They're good on the infrastructure side, but when it comes to consumers, they didn't have a consumer mindset. LG, Samsung, all those, Apple. And one of the things I could see coming was, you know, there was just extreme margin pressure in the business. And I realized, you know, the day is coming when they're going to ask me to fly coach to Asia. And when they do that, I'm done. And I mean, and where I started was, you know, if I was flying to Europe, I would fly first class over on British Airways and business back. And it was just amazing. It was absolutely amazing. And then Asia was always business class. And I was like, you know, the day they asked me to start flying coach to Asia, I'm done. And sure enough, that day came around and I was like, and it's kind of funny. I thought, I've been very successful in that world. I thought, well, let me go dispense my wisdom on the rest of society. And when I started doing this marketing, I ran across buddies from the semiconductor world, and they asked me what I've been up to. And I'd tell them I've spent the last decade discovering how little I know about marketing. And I realized that what they were doing in that world in terms of marketing, although it was high dollar, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, it was very crude in terms of the, you know, the tools that were available to them. They were only using a fraction. And for me, I mean, I was one of the few ones over there that had figured out that it's not about facts and figures. You know, we had a great product that was coming out. The engineer, designing great product, I had the luxury of launching and marketing that product. And the marketing plan about was not about the product. And I looked at somebody who had been really good. There was a Hewlett-Packard made test equipment. They've sold that division or rebranded that division a couple times. I think it's now called Keysight. But I noticed they didn't always have the best equipment, but they were always the first one that got the phone call. And I said, how did they do that? And I realized they were catering to other needs that engineers had. And so my marketing strategy for that product was to cater to those other needs in the same way Hewlett-Packard had done. And so when the competition came after us and started attacking the product, they didn't make any ground because our marketing wasn't based on the product. It was based on the underlying needs that the engineers had. Well, that was fairly rare thinking in the engineering, you know, in that semiconductor world. But when I left that world, I realized even doing that, there was so much I didn't know about marketing and the tools of persuasion that were available. And so that's how I sort of got into this, of just doing some more general marketing to smaller companies that aren't asking me to fly coach to Asia. And it's been really amazing. But one of the problems I ran into is, I mentioned, I'm not a salesperson. I'm actually horrible at sales. And because my wife likes food, shelter, and pretty things, and I wasn't delivering on those, something had to change. And I thought, well, if I can't sell, let me make an environment where people want to buy. And that was the genesis of this whole first-time offer concept.
There's nothing like a bit of motivation. So that always helps. And it's very interesting, the contrast between, or the similarity between what you mentioned with Hewlett-Packard and your own experience with your wife and doctors. So the doctors could be seen as the competitors, and your wife is obviously your offering. And it was that love and care, and knowing that you're going to be listened to, taken care of, and yeah, versus somebody new and shiny but is talking down on the product or being slightly negative. So I think there's a definite contrast there. The last thing I'll say on there as well is updating my resumes and writing. I'm doing a talk next week in December at a university talking about AI in the classroom, and I had to update my speaker's bios, and I was going through all the companies I worked for, and just like Motorola, Nokia, Ericsson, half the company's websites have changed because they've been bought out and changed. So it's amazing how nothing stays the same, and these industries just change so much. Last thing I want to touch on is, you're very inspiring to listen to, and obviously got some fantastic stories. I want to hear about your podcast, which is called Leaders and Legacies.
Yeah, so that's a podcast that I launched earlier this year. The inspiration behind it was what my team did when I was in the coma. I've been trying to be a good leader to my team. Didn't really see myself as, a brilliant leader. I was just like, well, this is what I have to do. And when I woke up and my wife started telling me what my team did in my absence, it just bowled me over. It absolutely bowled me over. And so when I started thinking about a podcast, I thought, there's a lot of everyday leaders out there. They're making a bigger impact in the lives of others than they realize. And I want to celebrate these people.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to share the link of that podcast with our listeners. And I think you've got a little something for our listeners as well.
Yes. So I have two gifts. One is a guide to making first-time offers that hopefully will help you avoid many of the mistakes I made, and I have made many. And the other is 23 days access to a course that we have to help you build first-time offers. The reason we limit it to 23 days is we study human behavior. And I know if I gave unlimited access to this course, you would sign up and never take it. And my goal is to see lives changed. And so by putting the 23-day limit on there, we see it in the analytics. People go in, they consume the content, it impacts them, and that is our goal. So the way they can get that is they go to our website, alliesforme.com, and that's spelled A-L-L-I-E-S, the number 4, M-E.com, and then just add a little slash WonderBrand, all lowercase, all one word, and that will take them to this content, and they can sign up, they'll get immediate access. And our mission is, I believe high ticket sales is broken, and I want to change it, and I believe this is the way to change it. And so I hope anybody that's listening that has a high ticket sale, please go there. It can be better for you and better for your customer.
Awesome. Well, I'm probably going to have a look at that course as well. Thank you. So I'll use that own WonderBrand code as well. So I'll share that in the podcast notes. But Craig, it's been a privilege chatting to you this evening. And I hope to chat to you again. And there are so many interesting subjects you touched on. So perhaps next time we'll dive deeper into one of those. But thank you so much for your time today.
Nicholas, this has been a real delight. Thank you.
Come chat with Nicholas. He'll listen to you. Then he'll laugh, and then he'll cry with you. It's all in a safe space for you to speak your truth. Oh, come and chat with